gentlemen, welcome to Minute 96 of Season 8 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we FUBAR our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again this season, hopefully for the entire week, is Scott Myers, an associate professor of screenwriting at DePaul University. Welcome back to the show this season, Scott.
Thanks, Rob. Great to be here. Enjoyed looking at Saving Private Ryan again. I look forward to talking with you about it.
Excellent. Me too. So actually, why don't we start from that point? What is your history with this movie? Do you remember when you first saw it? Is it a movie that
is
a favorite? You know, whatever.
I absolutely remember when it came out. Of course, I think most people will associate, their first association is that first 20 some odd minutes. Which is
I could say the exact number of minutes if you really wanted to.
How many minutes is it?
Well, it depends to what point are you're referring to, but it's the pretty much it's the first 28 minutes. The 29th minute already starts with them dealing with the letter. The 28th minute ends with is a point where they're showing Sean Ryan's body on the beach, you know. So it's a little longer than what you thought, but I think that's part of the. I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about that, but that's part of the idea here is you're not supposed to feel that it is 28 minutes. It's just it just time stands still, but goes really fast at the same time.
Yeah, it feels like real time.
Yeah.
But I do. Yeah, I remember seeing the movie in theaters. I was living in LA at the time, and so I think I saw it at the Writers Guild Theater in Beverly Hills with a bunch of other writers, and there was a lot of buzz about it afterwards. There were various scripts around, you know, script versions around, and I got hold of several of them, and so it's interesting to see some of the changes that were made, and as we'll see in when we talk about it, there were some changes made on set that they weren't reflected in the script either. But anyhow, yeah, it was a provocative movie that I think really caught people's attention.
Mm-hmm. When we get to it, I would love to hear your thoughts on those changes and stuff like that. Yeah. Do you remember how many times you saw it in the theater? You just saw it once or you went back again?
I only saw it once. I mean, back then, when I was working as a screenwriter in Hollywood, I tried to watch everything. And so it was very rare that I would watch something twice, unless it was something specifically related to like a project I was writing.
Right.
And I did see it in theaters once, and then I've seen it subsequently, you know, online a couple of times.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when was that, before rewatching it to do the research now, when was the last time that you saw it? You remember approximately?
I remember I did an article. You know, I host this blog called Go Under the Story. It's the official screenwriting blog of The Blacklist. And I remember featuring actually kind of some of this scene that we're talking about a little bit later in the process. But so that was probably about 5 years ago, maybe.
Oh, wow.
Was
this a script that appeared on a blacklist? Or not?
No, this was actually before The Blacklist. The Blacklist started in 2005. Mm. Saving Private Ryan came out in 1998.
Right.
So, The Blacklist didn't exist back then.
Oh, wow. Okay. Have you ever met the writer?
No. I know. I mean, I certainly know who he
is. Robert
Rodak. Yeah, I've never met him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Have you met anyone who's in the movie during the course? I mean, I don't think any of them were in K-9, but
No. I guess the closest association would be that, you know, K-9, which is a movie that I co-wrote, which was about a human policeman who gets a new partner and it's a police dog.
Jim Belushi.
Of course, we were in competition. Yeah, Jim Belushi. We were in competition with the Tom Hanks movie.
That's right.
Turner and Hooch. And so I guess that may be the one degree of separation. I saw him at a distance once, Tom Hanks, but I've never met him. And yeah, but that the fact that we were basically racing to see who would get to the theaters first was kind of an interesting experience with him as a rival, I guess.
Oh wow, interesting. Okay, I'm assuming that you prefer K9. But I won't
Yeah.
put you on
Well,
the spot.
I prefer getting those green envelopes every 3 months with my residuals, which I continue to get, so yeah.
Hey, why not? That works. Excellent. All right. So minute 96 begins with the prisoner describing what he loves about America and ends with the prisoner pleading for his life. So, well, first of all, since you said that it's been 5 years since you saw this movie, did you remember everything we're going to be talking about during the course of this week of it happening, or is it something that you saw with somewhat fresh eyes, rewatching it?
I guess it was somewhere in between. I mean, I remember sort of generally what was going on. I mean, this is an instance where there is something of substance different than the latest version of the draft that I script that I could find, because this is continuous between what happens here and then the resolution of the Steamboat Willie character, the German soldier. At least for now. Later, he shows back up later. But in the script, they have this moment, the Steamboat Willie, where he imitates the horn and all that stuff, and then they go on a whole thing. There's like a nighttime, and there's a fire fight. There's a it's it's not compressed together, and so that's an interesting choice that they made, where they just put all this stuff into one scene, basically.
Do you
But
think it was on the editing floor? They did that on the editing floor, or that was, when they shot it, they made those changes already?
No, I think they made it on, I know Liz Hanna, who wrote The Post, and of course Spielberg directed that, and she was on set, I think, for 6 or 7 weeks during that shooting, the filming of it. And Spielberg was very, I think, not reverential toward the script, but he's a strong advocate for the screenwriters, and obviously he's worked with them quite a bit on the material. But he does allow the actors to do a bit of improvisation, or he'll turn around. I remember him saying to Liz, "Do they really need to say that line? Can't they just deliver it with a look?" and that sort of thing. So when I watched this page, this minute in the movie, it's felt to me like they had either rehearsed this, or they improvised it on set, probably rehearsed it. I don't know about you, but the delivery that the actor was giving to these lines felt like Robin Williams. The whole Betty Boop, Gams, and What Addition, all that stuff. It just had that rhythm to it. And of course,
Interesting. I didn't
Spielberg
even think about
did.
that. Yeah.
I mean, Betty Boop, Gams. What Gams? It just felt like a Robin Williams routine. Of course, he did Hook with Spielberg, and there was this famous 40th birthday video. You can actually find it online, I think, on YouTube. This 40th birthday video for Spielberg, and Robin Williams was played a pretty significant part in it. So I think he was, he maybe Spielberg called him in and said, "Hey, what would this guy do to try and, win over the American soldiers?" Like pulling contemporary references. So I wouldn't be surprised if Robin said, did some stuff, and then this actor. But if you watch that, if you watch it and just think Robin Williams, it really does feel like, a bit, like a Robin Williams bit.
Yeah, wow, that's really interesting to think about it from that perspective. I never even thought about it, but what's I mean, you mentioned Robin Williams. I mean, it's a known fact that when Spielberg was doing Schindler's List, he would call Robin Williams every night to make him laugh.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So, and here we're talking just 4 years later, 5 years, depending on, when it was actually filmed, 4 or 5 years later. And so the fact that you brought this up, it makes a lot of sense that Spielberg would have called Robin Williams or something like that. Interesting.
Again, if you watch it and just think Robin Williams, it's just like, oh God, it just has the same delivery, same pattern, same, sort of speech pattern. Anyhow, that's my theory.
Right. Okay. From a screenwriting perspective, do you think it's nice to have this I guess you can call it Chekhov's Steamboat Willie, because he shows up again later? Or is it seem too much of a contrivance?
No, I thought it was very effective. You know, the fact that he does show up later is just, you know, dramatic irony 101. Undercuts Miller's decision, you know, that he makes here. So it adds to the complexity of it. And, you know, I studied theology, and there was a Jewish philosopher and theologian named Martin Buber, you may have heard of, and he wrote a book called
I've heard of him.
Ish und Du, I and You. And he talks about two types of relationships. One's an I-it relationship, where the person doesn't recognize the humanity in the other person. And then there's an I-you relationship, where you do. I'm sort of, you know, giving a brief version of it. But that's what's going on in this scene, is that this desperate German soldier is attempting to take these guys who are looking at him as an it, as the enemy, as a killer. You know, I mean, they say disparaging things about him, and, you know, and that kind of language that the military will use to dehumanize the enemy. And he's desperately seeking to connect with them on a human level. That's why he's doing all this stuff, you know, Love America and Betty Grable and, you know, Betty Boop and Steamboat Willie. He's trying to show that he, you know, he's a human being who can relate to them because they're Americans. So it's a really complex psychological scene going on. There's a lot of tension while he's being funny, trying to be lighthearted. So it's a makes for a very interesting scene, this exchange that happens in minute 96.
Yeah. Okay, so, I mean, why don't we go through the dialogue here? So, I mean, we ended things on Friday with the fact that, you know, they knew. Yeah, we started having the conversation between Upham and the character we will now refer to as Steamboat Willie. And so he starts off this minute by saying, Steamboat Willie. You know, talking about how much he loves America. You know, he even imitates a horn as he's doing that. And then he repeats it, and he goes, Steamboat Willie, American. And then, you know, as he's having this conversation with Upham, you see that Miller and some of the men show up. And, you know, both Steamboat Willie and Upham are basically taking a smoke break at this point. And, you know, Miller notices that, okay, you know, they're pretty much done with the job that I just gave them, you know, a few hours ago, whatever it is, you know, to dig these trenches and bury the bodies. So, you know, we don't really need them anymore. And he goes in and, you know, it's something you see a lot in movies, in military scenarios, you know, that when you put the gun, you know, the machine gun into the ground as the marker of where someone was buried, you know, upside down, where you usually have a helmet on top, you know, to try and show everyone, okay, this is where this is. So he takes out the clip from the gun itself, and then like throws it off to the side, you know, and we can hear the sound of the click as he like pulls it out and throws it out. But he Miller knows that, you know, he's reached a point where he's now going to be probably executing this prisoner, you know, for the whole thing. And at this point, Steamboat Willie then just turns to Upham and, you know, realizes what's going to be happening. And they basically pull him out of the trench. And, you know, it's Mellish who grabs him. And obviously he's the one, you know, it's understandable why Mellish would be the most forceful one of the group to do this. And then he basically breaks free from him and runs back into the trench to continue digging and saying, oh, look, I'm not done. And Upham then says he's not finished. Then Mellish goes, yeah, that's what you think. Come on. Yeah. And he goes, please, please, I like America. And now he's going to go through a whole list of things about what he loves about America. Fancy schmancy. What a cinch. Go fly a kite. Cat got your tongue. Cool beans. Betty Boop. What a dish. Betty Grable. Nice scams. And then he basically realizes he's looking around. Nobody's really paying any attention to him. And I mean, I like the way that they go man to man, showing us their reactions to what he's trying to do in order to save himself.
Yeah, that was a really smart choice by Spielberg, because you've got the contrast between him almost doing like a comedy bit. I mean, again, going sort of that Robin Williams thing, he's trying to make this a lighthearted moment, you know, to get them in a different mood. And you just see these steely gaze of each of them, including Miller. He's unmoved by this. They're all just staring at him, right? So the contrast between his performance in the while he's doing all this American jargon, and the silent disapproval and loathing on the part of the American soldiers, that contrast where he's cutting back and forth. I mean, that's Spielberg, you know, he's right. Just great at that.
Right. And obviously it makes sense. Also, they're you know, these are guys who just saw, you know, not long ago, one of their own that was just gunned down in the middle of this this firefight. And, you know, the only guy that they can blame is this one soldier who's still around, you know. So whether he pulled the trigger or not, it doesn't matter. He was part of the group that was you know, that was shooting at them, you know, from that perspective.
In the latest draft of the script that I think was before the shooting script or whatever they did on set, this routine that he does is interrupted. He does Steamboat Willie Oompa Oompa. And then the soldiers are you know, tell Steamboat Willie to cut the shit or I'll kill him, Reeve says, you know, I don't care what the captain says. And then Mellish, goose-stepping after, but it was him who killed Wade. So they go on. It's just like, it's mostly about them and their reactions, as opposed to just him desperately trying, as filmed, desperately trying to get the soldiers to warm up to him. So that was an interesting choice, to keep the focus on the soldier and then just see the silent non-dialogue reactions of the soldiers in this minute.
Do you think it makes it more effective?
Yeah, you know, I do. Again, that was one of the things that Liz Hanna told me about being on the set of The Post. She loves to write dialogue, and most of the comments that Spielberg would make after he would get done with the shot, he'd turn around to Liz and the co-screenwriter and say, do they really need to say, he kept cutting dialogue. He said, do we really need to say that? Can't they just do it with a look? Or can't Tom just do this with Meryl? You know, and it was a real lesson for Liz that Spielberg, you know, he knows it's a visual medium. It's a visual medium primarily. And so obviously dialogue's important. But if you look at this scene and you compare it to the most recent draft, it was dated June 13th, 1997. So that, you know, that was very close to when they were shooting the film, because mm-hmm. the film came out in the next year. That they just cut a lot of dialogue, you know, and that, I think that's an instinct that Spielberg has. Let's just show it, let's say it.
Right, and I mean it. I don't know how it would work, you know, if they would have kept that dialogue in. But it's just amazing it's amazing how well it does work without the dialogue, you know, just showing everyone's faces. You know, so I guess this Spielberg guy has a knack for this type of stuff. Maybe.
Oh, he loves close-ups. You know, the human face, right? And because it invites the audience to, you don't need to say what they're, you know, it invites us to participate in the moment. Like, God, what are these guys thinking? What are they feeling? And you see it etched on their face. And so it makes us more participatory, as opposed to having characters say exactly what's on their mind. No, let the silence. Sometimes the best dialogue is no dialogue, basically,
right.
That's true. What I'm trying to say.
That's true. Does that make it easier or harder for a screenwriter?
Yeah, well, for people who like to write dialogue, yeah, it does make it more of a challenge. I think that, you know, this gets much more into sort of, you know, the procedural aspect of it. Sometimes you do need to overwrite in the script just to make sure that the people who are reading it are getting it. But then if you're on set, you either have cut it through rehearsals, or you shoot it and then you cut it in post, you know. So it's not really overwriting in a bad way. It's just making sure that people get what's going on in the story. But if you I have my students do this all the time, which is watch a movie while reading the script. You'll see that they cut often they cut a lot of dialogue just because it's a visual medium and you don't know, you know, what's going to work best until you're in post and you see what the actors have done on set. And, you know, that's what they call it acting,
right?
You know, it's let them act, you know? So, yeah,
that's true. That's true. Yeah, no, we talked about this, probably a few months ago already at this point, when they first meet up with the wrong Ryan, with Minnesota Ryan. So they have a scene also there where they show everyone's reaction to this guy running. You know, we see each of the various characters, and the only line that they leave in there is Ryan saying, "Yeah, I told you he was in there," and that's it.
Yeah.
But everyone else has these various looks on their face about the whole thing. So I love the way they do that. So let's talk about some of the things they mention here. So Steamboat Willie. What do you know about Steamboat Willie?
Well, it's Walt Disney, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I think that was, if I'm not mistaken, was that his first animation?
It wasn't his first, but it was the debut of Mickey Mouse.
Mickey Mouse, that's right, yeah.
It came out in 1928. And it actually went into the public domain at the beginning of 2024. You know, so
yeah.
It's amazing just thinking about the fact that it's almost a century, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess the copyright thing is, what, 70-some-odd years or whatever? Disney kept fighting it in court for years to maintain ownership over it. And now it's finally with public domain, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, again, 96 years it took for it to get into the public domain. So it's very interesting. Okay, so he mentions the term fancy schmancy. Do you know when people started using that that phrase? I mean, again, they probably stopped using it because you don't really hear it that often. But
if I had to hazard, well, schmancy sounds Yiddish, so I don't know if it had some sort of a derivation from that culture, or whether, like during the jazz era of the 20s or something like that, it was picked up and populated. Maybe you know, but it sounds like something.
It's and you are 100% right. It was in the 30s they started using that that phrase. There's an author named Arthur Kober who used it in some of his writings in the 1930s. So right, that's fancy schmancy. Then the next thing that he says is, "What a cinch." So do you know what a cinch is?
Not really. I mean, cinch is like clinch something, I think. Or like it's a certain deal or whatever, but I don't really know the derivation of it, no.
No, so cinch has two meanings. One is something that's very easy to do. You know, it's something that sounds difficult, but it's actually, you can do it in a cinch. You can do it real quickly. And it also is it's a term used when you're putting together the bridle on a horse. You know, when you're like locking, you know, putting together the saddle or the pack and stuff like that. So that's like to cinch up.
Yeah, I think as a related to that, they call like cinching a tie, like you're putting a tie, you tighten it up. So maybe that it was a variation on what you were just talking about with the horse.
Right. Okay. Could be. Okay. Go fly a kite. I'm assuming you know what it means.
Don't know that. I mean, I know the phrase. You know, right. It's basically, I think it's meant as a kind of a negative, like just, you know, get out of here, or
exactly.
I disagree with you or something.
Right. The literal meaning is it's the literal activity of flying a kite, which is seen as a harmless and enjoyable pastime. But telling someone to go fly a kite can imply that they should engage in something trivial or lighthearted rather than continuing a serious conversation or argument. Just go fly a kite. Get out of here. Go do something simple. the earliest recorded use was in the 60s. So I guess that, maybe Steamboat Willie is a time traveler and was able to get that information beforehand. The idea is it's a way to give like a sense of dismissiveness type of thing. Just say, ah, forget about it and stuff like that. It's also the idea of flying a kite is the same as somewhat of an escape from reality type of things, in order to enjoy just the simple pleasures. So when you can basically say to someone, go fly a kite, it's saying, okay, leave here and get out of here because what we're dealing with is too complicated for you type of thing. It's obviously now part of colloquial speech because most people use it either in humorous or sarcastic ways, and usually it's used in very serious situations in order to sort of lighten the situation type of thing. Okay, next one is cat got your tongue.
Well, now this, my mom grew up in Texas during the 20s and very superstitious. And she, believed, I think this was kind of a superstition, that cats and babies don't mix. Like cats will suffocate babies. And so I'm imagining it has something to do with that. Like they're a threat and that they could somehow stifle someone from talking. But that's my long shot idea of the derivation of that phrase.
Okay, so it's the history of it is interesting because it's most people believe that the cat in the phrase is referring to a feline, but it's really referring to a cat of nine tails, which is a whip that they used to use in order to flog sailors who would misbehave. So on British ships, anyone who was given a secret by a higher officer and things like that, they'd be threatened that if you let out this information, the cat will get you, meaning that we're going to whip you. So when the idea is the cat got your tongue, it's you should be afraid to tell, that type of thing. That's where
Well,
that.
I like that explanation better than mine, so.
I liked yours. I didn't say it was a bad explanation. Okay, cool beans.
Oh man, I have no idea on that. I mean, it sounds sort of jazzy, but I have no idea.
Well, apparently, most people believe that the phrase was first used by Cheech and Chong in their movie Up in Smoke in 1978. And the idea is that it is somewhat connected to like jelly beans and stuff like that.
Well, cool. That would fit. I mean, because but the cool is like a reference, like that's interesting, or that's
Yeah, but did they use the term cool in the 40s? Probably not. It was because it's cool is something that seems more beatnik and stuff like that.
Beatnik.
Right. What's funny is that in the research that I did, so most things said it comes from the beatnik term cool and beans maybe the late 70s and stuff like that, and then someone brings an example and says, well, it was used in Saving Private Ryan and that took place in World War II, so it must have been around in World War II also. I don't know if you can really use this as a primary source. For whether it's true or not.
Well, unless maybe that German soldier was a time traveler.
Anything's possible. Definitely. Okay, the next thing he says is Betty Boop. So do
Now she was a very early star in the animation world.
you.
So that would have, I would think, I'm assuming it's sort of around the era of Steamboat Willie, maybe a little later, but because it was a little more sophisticated, I believe, than that Steamboat Willie
Yeah, it actually
animation.
debuted 2 years later. So it debuted in 1930. Obviously, they had to tone it down over the course of the 30s because of the hazes and stuff like that. Because you know, even as a cartoon, she looked a little too. I guess she showed a little too much skin, so they had to keep changing.
Yeah, a short skirt, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was she was in tons of short movies that they made throughout the 30s with the whole thing. And she actually even appeared in Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Oh, I've forgotten that.
Yeah. Okay, so the next phrase that he uses is what a dish.
Again, it's a lot of these things sound sort of like jazz oriented to me. You know, like I could imagine someone saying that like in the 20s, you know, the sort of roaring 20s, but I don't know. What a dish.
Once again, Scott, you hit it on the nail on you hit the nail on the head. It's from the 1920s. It's a phrase that was used, you know, during the jazz era, by saying, you know, what a dish, what a dish. So I mean, Sima Willy knows his pop culture from the 40s mostly so far.
Yeah.
The next thing he mentions is Betty Grable.
Okay, now I know a little bit about this because, you know, I have watched a lot of World War II movies, particularly when I was younger. And that picture, that very famous photograph of her in a swimsuit, you know, where she's staring over her shoulder, I think, over her right shoulder back at the cameraman with a big smile on her face. But the body is featured primarily from behind. But that was like, I think every soldier had that photograph, American soldier, you know, as quote unquote inspiration, I guess. But I think that's accurate. I mean, that was something that the soldiers took with them when they went overseas.
Right. Okay. The movie that always reminds me of it is Stalag 17.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, where
Stalag 17. Billy Wilder.
That's right. Shapiro and the animal are always drooling over this picture, this famous picture of Betty Grable.
Oh, wow.
And they have a great joke in the movie. Where they ask someone to do an impression of Grable and he does Clark Gable instead.
Yeah.
So she was an actress born in 1916 in St. Louis, and she passed away in 1973 at the age of 56. She was definitely a major sex symbol during the era that she made movies. She made 42 movies during the 30s and 40s, but she was mostly known because of her legs. She was considered, you know, she even is quoted as saying, "I became a star for two reasons, and I'm standing on them."
Great quote.
Exactly. Just a list of a few movies that show stuff dealing with Grable is I'm assuming you've seen the movie Battleground in 1949 about the Battle of the Bulge.
Yep.
So they talk about the fact that they talk about her there. Obviously, Stalag 17, as I mentioned. There's a movie called Our Miss Brooks. That has a connection to her, where it has a photo that was confiscated by someone else. There's a song that was made about her right after she passed away by Neil Sedaka called "Laughter in the Rain."
Mm. Oh, that was about her. Wow.
Mm. Yeah. Obviously, there was a Flying Fortress that had her picture on it in Nose Art. It's known as the Sentimental Journey, the name of the Flying Fortress. And then the final thing that he mentions here are nice gams. So,
well,
I'm assuming you know what a gam
seems. Well, gams refers to legs, right?
Correct. Yes, it actually is derived from the term gamb, GAMB, which is the leg of an animal on a coat of arms. Eventually, it came into American slang, and they started referring to it as as the legs of a pretty woman. Obviously, that wasn't the original idea, but it eventually turned into that. You have
You know,
the
it's interesting if you look at the these sides of dialogue, they're very brief, right? It's just like these catchphrases. Go fly a kite, cat got your tongue, cool beans, Betty Boop, what a dish, Betty Grable, the next games. I mean, that would make sense for a German who's got a limited understanding of, English, and the English he's drawing on is pop culture. A lot of it from these last two references in particular, deriving from film. So it just makes sense. It's like, I'm looking at it and I'm hearing in my head, I keep going back to this Robin Williams thing. It just has the same rhythm. I mean, you could just see him doing it. I mean, like, I don't know. It reinforces my theory by just going through
I
this
love your
dialogue.
theory. I think it works so well. You use that as the there's no question about that. During this whole conversation, he's trying to save his own life here, save his own skin, and the minute ends. So, was there anything else you want to say about this minute?
No, I just it, watching it again, it the air of desperation and the contrast between him, feels like I did stand-up comedy for 2 years. It feels like it has that rhythm. Like he's doing a performance. He's trying to break through to these guys, and then those contrasting shots, those images of each of the soldiers as they're staring at him, and we know what they're feeling, which is hatred and loathing and wanting of revenge. So the contrast, it's a really good moment, really, really well done. Like if you're like from a screenwriting standpoint, you're like, yeah, that really, really works. The way that it's filmed, it is a great what they managed to pull off in the filming part of it is really strong in terms of the storytelling.
Yeah, I love the way they do it. I really do. All right, so every Monday we have a segment called Maestro Monday, where my guests will give their top five John Williams movie theme scores. So, Scott, why don't you start off with your number five and work your way up?
All right. It's kind of, I do have a favorite, but it's mostly tied to family stuff. The others are just, I'm not sure that they're in order, but I'll start with Jaws, because it's just, that that one theme in particular is just so famous. Dun, 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 dun. I mean, it's, and the movies, the story behind the making of the movie itself, it's just all wonderful. I would say Schindler's List. It was a very haunting, the melody, the one that we remember most. Of course, Spielberg, I believe it took him like 10 years to come around to actually making it. He didn't feel like he was mature enough at some point. I remember reading about that. Powerful film. Jurassic Park, I think that soundtrack is quite memorable. The one movie that I would note that was not done by Spielberg is Superman. John Williams did the soundtrack for Superman, the score for Superman, the original one. And so that was really good. But the one that I would say is like my favorite has to be Star Wars 4, for two reasons. One, when I saw it was just Star Wars. I saw it when it came out. I was in graduate school at Yale. And after doing all that heavy academic work, this movie comes out, and I went to see it. My mind was blown. So I was taking my friends two or three times. We went to see the film. But the other thing is, I did go to see John Williams at the Hollywood Bowl, where he was with the orchestra there. And I took my little kid, who was a huge Star Wars fan, and he brought his lightsaber. And they
Of
were playing
course.
all these John Williams themes, right? Old one over and over. And I kept waiting for the Star Wars theme because that was one of the primary reasons I brought it, my kid there. And he did an encore, and he's not doing it. And I'm like, oh no, this is going to be such a bummer. And finally, he played it. And when you hear that, da, 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 you know, you could just, my kid's just face lit up, you know, and everybody cheered. It was really a great ending to that concert. So I would say that the original score for the first Star Wars is probably my favorite of the soundtrack that he did.
Yeah, okay. That's completely understandable. All right, excellent. So, Scott, would you like to tell people where they can find you?
I have the blog I mentioned earlier, GoIntoTheStory.com. As I said, it's the official screenwriting blog of The Blacklist. I'll be celebrating its 17th birthday in May. I launched it in 2008. And it's pretty popular, I think, with the screenwriting community. I do teach at DePaul University in Chicago, the film school there. I have an online educational resource called Screenwriting Masterclass. I've been doing that now since 2011, taught hundreds and hundreds of people there. And I think that's probably, my book. Yeah. I wrote a book that came out almost 3 years ago called The Protagonist's Journey, a little bit of an homage to Joseph Campbell and The Hero's Journey. The Protagonist's Journey, an Introduction to Character-Driven Screenwriting and Storytelling. And that's done really well. I'm very, very pleased that the book was number one book on Amazon and it's film and TV for like 7 months. It's being adopted now in film schools, which I'm very happy to hear because I think character-driven storytelling is the best storytelling. So those are the key things for me.
All right. Very cool. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, MovieRobMinute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to MovieRobMinute@MovieRob.net. So, until tomorrow, earn this.
My solitude, you